Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1045, interview number 14 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airways Jim DiEugenio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
I checked in between the recording of our last interview and this one, and yes, indeed, Bernardo de Torres was believed by associates to have been linked to the assassination of Orlando Letelier. That, according to William Davey in his book, Let Justice Be Done, and he wrote a preface to your book as well.
Right, that's correct.
All righty. In terms of what, bearing in mind that the median age now in the U.S. is something like 37 or 38 years of age, so many Americans have heard what they have heard about JFK in general, his administration in general, his assassination in general, and the Jim Garrison investigation of same. Through the media and also through our established historical outlets. And I think there is no more important part of your book than discussion of the media hatchet man. As I've indicated in past discussions on air and off air with you, in a democracy, in our country, we depend on the media for the information upon which we base not only our outlook, but our resultant actions in the political realm. And in examining how the media behaved in connection with, at one level, Jim Garrison's investigation, and at another level, the JFK assassination in general, is altogether remarkable. We almost concluded our last interview with my reading of a section of your book about Marlene Mancuso, who was Gordon Novell's estranged wife, and she was threatened to change her testimony and to perjure herself, and followed around by, among others, Walter Sheridan, whom we will discuss at some length. And Walter Sheridan mentioned to her that if she would change her testimony and begin cooperating with him instead of Garrison, that he would get her a job at NBC, which is not only interesting in terms of the JFK and Garrison situations per se, but very interesting about the way, quote, the system, unquote, works. And as I said, that is reminiscent of the Denver oil man King and the proposal he made to Garrison. In talking about Walter Sheridan, a really, really important individual in the development of what happened with Jim Garrison, he was producing a television special. It was a very special special indeed.
That's putting it mildly. It was a special special. It was so unusual, okay, that we know today, for example, that the CIA was funneling money to Sheridan for the production of this. See, it was originally, Dave, very few people know this, and I decided to do a lot of work on this NBC special, all right, because I think it bears a lot of examination as to what happened to Jim Garrison.
Absolutely. Right? And by the way, let me just briefly butt in again. I think that it is one of the most important parts of your book, and as deeply as you would like to go into the Walter Sheridan. Very special, special. I'm, you know, green light.
Green. I like that. The very special, special.
Oh,
yeah.
It was special, all right. Very special indeed. I'd like to go into that in as much detail and as at great length as you would like. I think in the context of his offer to Marlene Mancuso, though, even talking about the deep political history / connections of NBC, on which this very special special was aired, and talking about the history of that institution, because really in what you have portrayed about Walter Sheridan, what you have revealed about how he proceeded, with whom he worked, who was providing the underwriting and the giving him the tools he needed to do what he did, it really should not come as a great surprise that NBC would be sort of the media godfather, and I use the term advisedly, of his activities.
Well, see, Sheridan, a lot of people have quoted Sheridan as being part of ONI and a former FBI agent. But I dug up some information from Victor Novosky, and who was the longtime editor of The Nation. And he did a book on Bobby Kennedy called Kennedy Justice. He found out that Sheridan was actually a counterintelligence officer for the NSA.
Right.
Okay, now, why is that so interesting? Because if he's counterintelligence for the NSA, that means in all likelihood he's interfacing with James Angleton, because James Angleton was the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA.
Right.
All right? And those two organizations were pretty close, to put it mildly. All right? And so when I saw that, the proverbial light went on in my head. All right? And I began to see, you know, just what Sheridan was up to in both the macro way, all right, that is, with the hatchet job on Garrison. But I also began to wonder if just maybe it was even bigger than that, that if he was, like, say, for, let's put a figure of speech, was he Alan Dulles's guy in the Kennedy camp? Okay? That's the other thing I began to think about. And this is why I wrote so many pages on both the program and Walter Sheridan. Now, let me add one other thing. You started this about the absolute horrendous performance of the media in the Kennedy assassination. But you probably mean that in a much more wider scope than that, because it is that bad. But we shouldn't forget something else that was going on in the summer of 1967. And that was, in addition to the NBC hatchet job on Jim Garrison, CBS did an extraordinary, unprecedented, four-night apologia for the Warren Commission. And these two shows went on within like a couple weeks of each other. So in other words, Dave, if you're really examining this, like, say, a sociologist would or a media analyst would, what's happening here is that with the issuance of about four very, very interesting best-selling books, and by that I mean Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment, Edward Epstein's Inquest, Sylvia Marr's Accessories After the Fact, and Josiah Thompson's 6 Seconds in Dallas, which was actually on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. With the publication of those four books, plus the exposure of Jim Garrison's investigation, there now began to be a crack in the dam. All right? In other words, the public was now beginning to think, wait a minute. Was the Warren Commission just a big joke? You know? I mean, it sure looks that way. And so what happened is that the powers that be in the higher offices of NBC and CBS, and by the way, I'm not making this up. I wrote a long two-part article just on the CBS special, okay, which you can Google by saying, you know the how CBS aided the JFK cover-up. And that was made up of mostly internal CBS documents, okay? And I'm not exaggerating. See, at the upper levels, that would mean at NBC, David and Robert Sarnoff, David was the father, Robert the son, okay? And over at CBS with people like, for example, William Paley and Dick Salant, all right, who were at the upper levels of Paley actually ran the network. Salant was the titular president, all right, that they began to literally scheme and plot in order to go ahead and restore the belief in the Warren Commission.
Oh, interrupting, and, Jim, very briefly, is that article that you wrote about the CBS special, is that on the Kennedys and King website or archived there?
Yes, yes.
Okay, very good.
Yes.
So the people who would like to examine that at length can do so on the Kennedys and King website. Go ahead, Jim.
Right. And so they gave these guys, and I'm talking about the mid-level and lower-level reporters and employees, they gave them almost a carte blanche, okay, to do what they needed to do to restore the belief in the Warren Commission report. And again, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, in Destiny Betrayed, I go into the interaction of Robert Sarnoff in New Orleans with Dean Andrews, okay? Robert Sarnoff went ahead and made some promises to Dean Andrews if he would go ahead and trash Garrison on national TV.
Oh, interrupt you,
David
Jim,
Sarnoff. David Sarnoff, yeah, wrote a memo to Rick Townley, shoot him down.
Yep.
Okay.
Dean Andrews, very quickly, a New Orleans attorney who had been previously contacted by Clay Shaw to represent some gay Latinos, and then got a call a day or two after the assassination from Dallas from Clay Shaw, whom Clay Bertrand, to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. And then later he expressed fear for his life and turned on Garrison. Garrison ultimately got a perjury conviction of Dean Andrews. So that's who he was. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes. And so what happened is that these two entities, NBC and CBS, then began to go ahead and break every journalistic ethic that you can imagine in the production of those two shows, all right? And it was probably even worse with the NBC special. See, because Sheridan had this background in intelligence work, you know, with the FBI, ONI, and NSA, so he knew exactly what to do in order to intimidate witnesses and to go ahead and arrange a complete one-sided counterattack, you know, to destroy somebody's reputation, all right? And so he began to go ahead and intimidate witnesses using the carrot and stick approach, that is, offer them something that, like, for example, Marlene Mancuso, a job at NBC. If that doesn't work, you physically threaten them, which is what literally happened in that particular case. Same thing with Perry Russo. They offered him a job in wherever he wanted to go. You need a job in California? I can get you a job in California if he would denounce Garrison. I think you want to read the best example of this is the Fred Lehman's affidavit.
Yeah.
So go ahead and read that one.
Okay, I'll go ahead and do that. I was going to do that later in the program, but no, this is a good time to do that. You mentioned that Walter Sheridan, again, with NBC, one of the things that you talk about in Destiny Betrayed is the long history of the Sarnoffs and NBC with the intelligence community going back to the Second World War and its immediate aftermath. They were involved with the birth of Radio Free Europe, inextricably linked with CIA, etc. And you mentioned, Jim, that correctly, that CBS and NBC violated every ethic of journalism in order to produce these specials, and especially the very special special of Walter Sheridan. I would supplement that by saying they did more than that. They broke the law. I mean, they at least Walter Sheridan did. I'm not privy to any necessarily law-breaking activities of the CBS. Of course, the thing itself is a lie and a cover-up. But on page 240 and 241, you write, and Fred Lehman's, as a preface to this, he, you mentioned, you write, was maybe the single most important witness, quote unquote, for Walter Sheridan in this special. Can you briefly, before I read this, fill us in on what exactly he did for the special?
Lehman said that he had seen Clay Shaw with Oswald at a sauna place that he was running, okay? All right? Now, there's a little problem with the story, I mean, because, you know, Oswald was not supposed to have been in Louisiana at that time, all right? But it could still be true, of course, because we know, well, pretty much certain that there was more than one Oswald scampering around down there in the Louisiana area. So he told Garrison that he had seen Oswald with Shaw, okay? And that was the significance, you know, because Shaw was denying that he ever knew Oswald. That was the significance of him as a witness.
And you mentioned that this very special, Fred Lehman's actually said that he had been offered $2,500 by Jim Garrison to concoct that story.
Right.
And this.
And by the way, let me add one more thing.
Sure.
About the importance of Lehman's testimony, Sheridan saved him for last. He was the last witness that Sheridan brought on the show. So he clearly meant him to be the final knockout punch.
Yeah, and the in terms of presentation and literary psychology, the first thing, the last thing, the things that are repeated are the things that tend to stick in people's minds.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Again, bearing in mind what you said correctly about violating journalistic ethics, there is a whole lot more than that being violated here. On pages 240 and 241, you write the following. In January of 1969, Lehman's, again, L-E-E-M-A-N-S, signed an affidavit in which he declared the following as the true chain of events. I would like to state the reasons for which I appeared on the NBC show and lied about my contacts with the district attorney's office. First, I received numerous anonymous threatening phone calls relative to the information I had given to Mr. Garrison. The gist of these calls was to the effect that if I did not change my statement and state that I had been bribed by Jim Garrison's office, I and my family would be in physical danger. In addition to the anonymous phone calls, I was visited by a man who exhibited a badge and stated that he was a government agent. This man informed me that the government was presently checking the bar owners in the Slidell area for possible income tax violations. This man then inquired whether I was the Mr. Lehman's involved in the Clay Shaw case. When I informed him that I was, he said that it was not smart to be involved because a lot of people that had been got hurt and that people in powerful places would see to it that I was taken care of. One of the anonymous callers suggested that I change my statement and state that I had been bribed by Garrison's office to give him the information about Clay Shaw. He suggested that I contact Mr. Irvin Diamond, that's D-Y-M-O-N-D, attorney for Clay L. Shaw, and tell Mr. Diamond that I gave Mr. Garrison the statement about Shaw only after Mr. Lee, Garrison's assistant DA, offered me $2,500. Parenthetically, he did make that statement in the very special special. Continuing with Lehman's affidavit. After consulting with Mr. Diamond by telephone and in person, I was introduced to Walter Sheridan, investigative reporter for NBC, who was then in the process of preparing the NBC show. Mr. Diamond and Mr. Sheridan suggested that I appear on the show and state what I had originally told Mr. Diamond about the bribe offer by the district attorney's office. I was informed by Mr. Diamond that should the district attorney's office charge me with giving false information as a result of the statement I had originally given them, he would see to it that I had an attorney and that a bond would be posted for me. In this connection, Mr. Diamond gave me his home and office telephone numbers and advised me that I could contact him at any time of day or night should I be charged by Garrison's office as a result of my appearing on the NBC show. My actual appearance on the show was taped in the office of Aaron Cohn, that's A-A-R-O-N, last name K-O-H-N, managing director of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, in the presence of Walter Sheridan and Irvin Diamond. Again, Irvin Diamond, one of Clay Shaw's attorneys. Then in the next few sentences, you go on to write, Jim, this is one of the most revealing documents portraying the lengths to which Sheridan would go in tampering with witnesses. It also demonstrates that Shaw's lawyers, Bill and Ed Wegman, W-E-G-M-A-N-N, Irvin Diamond, and Sal Panzeca, P-A-N-Z-E-C-A, knew almost no boundary in what kind of help they would accept to win their case. Third, it reveals that Shaw's lawyers had access to a network of attorneys that they could hire at any time for any witness they could pry loose from Garrison. Because as the declassified ARRB documents reveal, there was a CIA-cleared attorneys panel that was at work in New Orleans. Attorneys that the agency vetted in advance so they would be suitable for their covert use and could be trusted in their aims. The fact that Shaw's lawyers were privy to such secret CIA knowledge and were utilizing it shows just how willing and eager they were to indulge themselves in covert help and then lie about it. And I appreciate yours and the audience's indulgences in allowing me to read so much. That is such an important, powerful passage, Jim, and it really exemplifies why I'm going into the lengths that I'm going into in dealing with Destiny Betrayed, because that not only has the most profound implications for the investigation of the murder of the president of the U.S., but really when you see how things work, that I think is the prism through which so much of what we see in the world around us has to be conceptualized, is that that's how it can be done.
Yes. all this was done, of course, this stuff didn't come out for quite a long time afterwards. And when it did come out, of course, the MSM ignored it, right? But to me, I think it's of the utmost importance, right? Because, as you said earlier, it shows you just how in bed that the networks were with the CIA, the FBI, Washington, D.C., in order to go ahead and crush this growing disbelief that Kennedy had been killed by a conspiracy, a high-level conspiracy. And so another way to look at this is this is how far they would go in risking exposure of their covert domestic operations and their incestuous ties with the media. Okay? To my knowledge, nothing like that had ever been done before on the scale that they did it here. Okay? That they took all these risks, you know, and risking so much exposure, you know, of so much of this illicit behavior. You know, I don't recall anything like this ever happening before with what we have come to call Operation Mockingbird, all right, which is the CIA's attempt to control the media, all right? So that is really, and when you think of it in that manner, all right, and I think you really have to.
Absolutely.
Then you begin to see how much was at stake in both the assassination of President Kennedy and in the successful subversion of Jim Garrison. You know, I mean, it was a lot.
It was.
For them to do the things that they did, there was a lot at stake.
You know, I'm thinking you mentioned Mockingbird, one of the primary architects of the CIA's media component. By the way, there's an excellent article that came out in the Rolling Stone magazine authored by Carl Bernstein talking about this. But one of the major architects of what he termed the Mighty Wurlitzer was Frank Wisner, a deputy director of CIA, and also formerly a counsel at Carter Ledger Newbern, which was the general counsel for the Dow Jones Corporation. I've forgotten the name. Leslie Liebler, who investigated the white Russian connections, a key Warren Commission counsel, was from that very same law firm. So there's a lot of institutional continuity between the deep political power players and how things actually sorted out on the media battlefield. And I think that's an appropriate term in light of what people like Marlene Mancuso and Fred Lehman's experienced. Tell us more about Walter Sheridan.
All right, Sheridan is a really fascinating character who I don't think anyone had really done enough work on before I decided to really sink my teeth, you know, into this whole NBC special thing, all right? And so Walter Sheridan had a kind of multi-tasked background in intelligence work, right? ONI, FBI, and also NSA, National Security Agency. And that's kind of important because according to Victor Novosky, Sheridan was actually a kind of high up counterintelligence officer in the NSA, which would mean that if such was the case, then he most likely was interfacing with James Angleton, who was the counterintelligence chief of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, which is, I think, really kind of important in more than one way, all right? But that was his background when he went to work for Bobby Kennedy. All right, he introduced himself to Bobby Kennedy after a church service. All right, I think in Virginia. All right, and he made it a point to go ahead and get a meeting with RFK, and so RFK decided to hire him. And what happened is that he worked very importantly in the whole anti-Hoffa effort by the Justice Department. Okay, after that, he went to work for NBC, all right? And as we have seen, his most famous show, okay, was this one, all right? The profile of Jim Garrison, all right? And so what has happened now is that with the declassified files of the ARB, we now begin to see how Sheridan used his talents that he honed with the FBI and the NSA to go ahead and threaten and intimidate witnesses in order to put together a very one-sided, almost maniacal hit piece that was okayed by Robert and David Sarnoff in New York. And let me add one other thing. The original plan for this program was that it was going to be two parts, all right? 1 hour and then a second hour, all right? It met with so much controversy that they didn't, but I found out that some of the money that was being used for the show, off the books money, in order to bribe witnesses and pay people like Gordon Novell, that was funneled by the CIA through a large law firm in New Orleans called Monroe and Lemon, all right? And Monroe and Lemon, of course, was the law firm for WDSU, okay, which was the NBC flagship in New Orleans, okay, in which Sheridan worked out of, and they were huge backers of Clay Shaw, all right? So this is all this background information has come out. And let me add one more thing I should say. The ARB subpoenaed the outtakes of this program from NBC, all right? NBC transferred the outtakes to the surviving family of Walter Sheridan, so they would not be subject to the subpoena. So when the ARB tried to get these outtakes from the family of Sheridan, they would not cooperate.
So I think Sheridan has passed away then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. All right. So that is the background to this horrendous show, which did so much to damage the reputation of Jim Garrison. Okay, and I believe the other thing that it did is it encouraged other media outlets to go ahead and go after Garrison at the same time that it encouraged certain attorney generals, right, not to go ahead and comply with his extradition and subpoena requests, because now he's pictured as just being pretty much of a loose cannon nutcase, all right? And so there really wasn't any need to go along with these guys' mad theories, all right? Now, let me add one other thing, a coda to this. One of the things that Ronald Reagan did when he became president, is that he was determined to get rid of something called the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine goes hand in hand with what we call the equal time provision.
Right.
And I'm sure you're familiar with this,
yes,
since you've been working in the media for a very long time. But to let your audience understand what it meant was, back in those days, all right, if you unleashed any kind of personal attack on a person in the media or in politics or anything like that, that person, if he perceived that it was unfair or one-sided, that person could submit a petition to the Federal Communications Commission, all right? And in that petition, if they made a strong enough case, they would be granted something called equal time to reply. And believe me, I can tell you that people in the media were really worried about this, okay? It was because the FCC granted a lot of these things, all right? And they gave it a lot of attention. And it worked. It worked as a check on tabloid journalism, all right? Well, when Garrison saw this show, he went ahead and put a petition together, and he was, by the Fairness Doctrine, he was granted an opportunity to reply, all right? It wasn't equal time because he only got a half an hour and his show was an hour. But for the first time, people got to go ahead and listen to Jim Garrison unfiltered live on television. And by the way, I think you can see it on YouTube. I think it's on YouTube now. So that's how bad the show was, all right, that Jim Garrison actually got an opportunity to reply. You know, I can't tell you, I don't know how you feel about it, but I really, really think that that was a terrible mistake getting rid of that.
Oh, yeah, by the way, I agree. It is convenient in some ways, and now maybe perhaps in the internet age, somewhat irrelevant because the major internet providers have successfully portrayed themselves to the FCC as common carriers rather than broadcast outlets. If you know, I do a disclaimer before my programs on behalf of the stations, but the internet permits people to they have successfully convinced their regulators that they're like the phone company, and therefore if somebody is yakety-yakking on the phone, they're not responsible. So it is perhaps irrelevant, but certainly before the internet age, and Reagan did that well before that, it was indeed a major transition point for the media. We should perhaps mention that Ronald Reagan was also a member of the Rockefeller Commission investigating possible CIA involvement with the JFK assassination and concluded, not surprisingly, that there was none. So he was not altogether disinterested in this particular situation.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Again, Jim, you're... deep dive into Walter Sheridan is very important in this. And bear in mind, well, I want to get to the Metropolitan Crime Commission, too, because that was something that Fred Lehman's alluded to and figures in this. Tell us about Sheridan and Sergio Arcacha Smith. That is one of the really interesting when you delineate how Garrison wanted to speak with Arcacha Smith in Dallas and then how Sheridan and company, and there's a pun there, then descended on Arcacha Smith and gamed that particular situation.
Right. In that particular instance, what happened was that Sergio Arcacha Smith was a representative of the Cuban exile government in New Orleans, all right? And he then went ahead And in about, I think, 1962, he left New Orleans and he moved to Dallas, okay? All right, now, as Garrison went ahead and began to investigate 544 Camp Street, all right, the home of Guy Bannister's alleged private detective agency, he began to figure out that, hey, this Sergio Arcacha Smith guy is a pretty interesting person, all right? And so maybe we should go ahead and talk to him. All right, well, certain people in Sheridan's camp at this time, that would include people like Bill Gurvich and Hugh Ainsworth, all right, learned about this. In fact, Gurvich probably told Ainsworth and Sheridan. And they went ahead and they went to Dallas before Garrison's representatives got there. And, of course, they wanted to talk to Sergio Arcacha Smith. All right? And so what happened is, all right, is that Arcacha Smith then went ahead and met Garrison's representatives, all right, and he would only talk to them, all right, if, A, police officers were there and an attorney be present. Arcacha requested William Alexander of the New Orleans DA office be his attorney, a famous Warren Commission apologist, all right? And so what happened now is that the interview was now over, all right, and Garrison's representatives went ahead and they left. Well, Ainsworth stayed in town, all right, and he began to interview Arcacha Smith, and he actually went ahead and met him at the Dallas police office, and he began to go ahead and tell him all these horrible stories about what Jim Garrison was up to in the presence of the Dallas police. So in other words, the idea was not just to poison Arcacha Smith's mind, but it was also to poison the Dallas police, okay? And they began to whitewash Sergio Arcacha Smith's background and demonize Garrison. So if you can see, and if that's important, because it's in a small way, it's played out on the national media that Garrison really didn't have a case, that nobody he was after was of any importance at all, and that he was really a kind of crackpot, you know, who nobody should pay any attention to. All right? And that's a very nice micro study, all right, of what happened on a much, much larger scale, thanks to Walter Sheridan and people like him.
Yeah, Bill Alexander, wasn't he actually with the Dallas legal establishment? You mentioned New Orleans. I thought, was it the same? There was a Bill Alexander who was present with...
Yeah, Bill Alexander was in the Dallas DA's office.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Did I say New Orleans?
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, no, that's a mistake. He was in the Dallas DA's office.
Right, I just want to make sure it was the same guy, because he, in fact, Jack Ruby, I think, requested that he be one of the people removed from the room before he would speak with Earl Warren.
Right.
And so, yeah, very interesting fellow indeed. So was it Hugh Ainsworth then who was doing the heavy lifting with Arcacha Smith? I remember
yes,
it being.
Yes.
Okay. Not
yes.
Sheridan.
But Ainsworth, of course, Ainsworth and James Phelan, okay, and Rick Townley, they were all in league with each other.
Right.
All right. You know, by this time. Once Sheridan got into New Orleans, which I believe is around February, okay, and camped out there, all right, then that became their kind of focal point, because that was going to be a nationally televised documentary special, All right. And so they all began to work with him. All right. You know, and this didn't just include the journalists. This also included people like Gordon. Gordon Novell began to work with Sheridan. And it was all, you know, in a clear attempt to go ahead and malign Garrison to the point that would reduce him to something like a caricature. And unfortunately, it began to work.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
It did. Jim, before we go to not only Ainsworth, but James Phelan, the guy I'd like to talk about, we should perhaps go back to the Metropolitan Crime Commission and Aaron Cohn, because Fred Lehman's mentioned that his testimony was filmed for the NBC, very special, at the office of the Metropolitan Crime Commission and in the presence of Aaron Cohn and Irv Diamond. If Aaron Cohn and the Metropolitan Crime Commission were not disinterested parties in this entire scenario.
No. See, Aaron Cohn had worked for the FBI for, I think, about 7 or 8 years, right? And the Metropolitan Crime Commission was not a public entity. It was a private entity, all right? And clearly what the Metropolitan Crime Commission was meant to do was to go ahead and publicize certain things in which the powers that be in New Orleans did not think that either the newspapers or the DA's office were doing a good enough job with, all right? And so somebody like Aaron Cohn would be important for the simple reason that because he's been in the FBI for so long, all right, that he could go ahead and use information that he would garner from his friends there, all right, and use that to go ahead and make these lurid stories about, some of them were about Garrison, all right, some of them were about Garrison's alleged cozy relationship with mafia leaders down there, like Carlos Marcello, all right? And so every once in a while, Garrison would actually have to call Aaron Cohn before the grand jury, all right? Okay, what is your backup for these things that you're saying about me, you know, or somebody else, all right? And most of the time, he didn't have anything, all right? So Aaron Cohn became important because he joined in with Clay Shaw's lawyers to work against Jim Garrison. And I think I wrote in my book, I also found out that Aaron Cohn was very much prejudiced against Italians. And so his desire was to go ahead and insinuate that the JFK assassination was really a mafia hit. Okay? All right? Mm-hmm. And so these are the kind of uses that he was to Shaw's lawyers and the FBI during the Garrison inquiry.
Indeed. You mentioned briefly James Phelan, and he also wore the twin hats of, quote, journalist, unquote, and also associate of the Federal Intelligence and Law Enforcement Establishment.
James Phelan?
Yeah.
Okay. I wrote a lot about Phelan, okay?
You did indeed.
All right. James Phelan,
and by the way, Jim, we can go into him.
A long-time reporter,
yeah.
Okay, for establishment entities, for example, like the New York Times and the Saturday Evening Post. All right. He wrote one of the earliest and one of the most pernicious stories that there was about Jim Garrison, all right, in, I think it was May of 1967, all right? And this was a cover story, I believe. It wasn't a cover story, it was a feature story, that's for sure. In the Saturday Evening Post, in which he cast aspersions over almost every aspect of Garrison's investigation and said that somehow Jim Garrison had drugged Perry Russo into remembering this so-called meeting at which Shaw and Ferry and Oswald began to speak about a plot to assassinate JFK. All right? Well, I never really kind of bought that ugly spin that Phelan put on that story for many reasons. And so I examined it in the book. I examined it in detail to show all the problems with Phelan's version of the story, all right, because it didn't turn out to be what he said it was, to put it mildly. But the other thing that always bothered me is that Phelan always denied that he had any ties to any government agency or that any government agency had ever read anything that he had written before it was published. Well, that turned out to be another lie, okay, because the ARB declassified several documents which showed that Phelan did work with government agencies in order to, and then he did show them his written product before it was published. And, you know, this was one of the most interesting things that was declassified. But I found two instances of this, all right, which, of course, Phelan even denied, even when I showed him the documents, all right. Phelan was a real weird character. I mean, he would call me up. He would send me registered letters just to be sure that I read them. You know, it really bothered him that I was the first guy to puncture his image, and on top of that, to actually get the documents that showed that he was lying about his actual role in, you know, detonating Garrison, all right? And so I'm really glad that we finally put together several good pages in a book, about six or seven good pages in a book, all right, in which, you know, Phelan was finally exposed, you know, for the hack journalist that he really was. All right. Now, also, the other guy I talked about in my book was Hugh Ainsworth, all right, who really, almost from the day Kennedy was killed, was determined on keeping the cover-up in place and not let it spread out so that the people could get a really clear look at what happened to JFK. He was stationed in Dallas at the time, and he claimed to be in several very important places, you know, at certain crucial times. You know, there's some people who would argue with that. But very early on, he actually began to send communications to the Warren Commission insisting that they go ahead and put out an Oswald did it, you know, kind of verdict. And he never, ever, he's around to this day, and he never, ever, ever has relented on that, no matter how much evidence says that it's wrong. And I think today, you know, you have literally the overwhelming amount of evidence that says that that idea is wrong. But Ainsworth is never, ever going to change his mind on this. So he went down to New Orleans, and he worked with his buddies, Walter Sheridan and Jim Phelan, and he did another hit piece on Jim Garrison, and I think that was also in May of 1967. So what you had was, you had Phelan's article, which I believe was first, all right, and then you had Ainsworth's article, which I believe was second, and then you had Walter Sheridan's hit piece, the broadcast version. And those were three very, very big, as they will say, left hooks, right cross, okay? that really injured Garrison's reputation. Now, Ainsworth, of course, is another one of these guys who would never admit that he was in bed with either the FBI, the CIA, or both. Well, we found a document that said that he was an informant for the FBI and the White House. All right, and somebody asked him, by the way, back, I think, in 1993 or something, that very same question. You know, did you ever, you know, show your work product to the FBI or any other government agency before it was printed? And, of course, like Phelan, he lied his head off, and he said no. And then somebody read him this document that was in my the original version of Destiny Betrayed. Okay, which saying that he is informing, and it's in this one too, page 251 and 252. All right, you want me to read it?
You know, Jim, we have just a couple of minutes left. Let's save that one for our next interview as an element of transition.
Fine.
I also want to talk about Robert Kirkwood and also review a little bit about George Lardner, who has spanned a great deal of time. You know, it's very interesting you mentioned that the Phelan hit piece was in the Saturday Evening Post, because you have written on page 256 about the Three Eyes, which was an investigative unit that was used by Walter Sheridan when he was investigating the
Hoffa
case.
Right, right. It was a private investigative, I think it was called Intelligence Investigators or something like that.
International Investigators Incorporated, yep.
Okay, and it was used by Sheridan in the Get Hoffa effort. But Jim Hogan did some very good work on this, and he found out that even though it was supposed to be a privately owned business, it was really a CIA shell company. So that's really, really interesting that Sheridan would be that much, you know, in bed with the Central Intelligence Agency, you know, to actually use a private shell company when he was working for the Department of Justice.
And you mentioned that a key guy from page 256, one of them, one of the former former CIA guys with the Three Eyes, one of them, Bert, B-E-U-R-T, Servaas, capital S-E-R, capital V-A-A-S, later purchased the Saturday Evening Post. And that was
that's what they call the whipped cream on the cake, right?
Well, it shows, what it really shows, you know, our political culture and media, you know, they go, ew, conspiracy theory, ew, icky poo, I don't want, ew. What this really shows is the networking that is responsible for so much of the malfeasance on one hand, and the deliberately crafted misperception on the other. And it continues to this day. We'll talk more about some of these people, including Ainsworth, in our next discussion, because the media blitzkrieg really has continued. And Robert Kirkwood, I think, is somebody who is worthy of attention as well. We have just a couple of minutes left. Jim, you made an allusion to an article that you wrote about the CBS hit piece on Garrison. That is on Kennedy's and King. Why don't you tell us about that website and how they can order JFK, The Evidence Today, and Destiny Betrayed, and Black Op Radio.
All right. The website is kennedysandking.com, and that article I mentioned to you, why CBS covered up the JFK assassination, you can go ahead and Google that. It'll take you that very, very interesting piece. You can also order my two books, all right, which are the latest two are The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the book we're talking about, which is Destiny Betrayed, the second edition. And I'm also a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's Black Op Radio program, broadcast on Thursday evenings.
Alrighty, so those of you who would like to learn more follow my frequent recommendations that you get a hold of Destiny Betrayed. And I should say that even though as massive a deep dive as this is, there is an awful lot that we will not be able to get to just simply because there is so much there. I wound up underlining or making notes on practically the whole book. That would be almost a book in and of itself. So please do follow up on this. We will be following up with more interviews about what took place in New Orleans and Dallas and subsequently. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1045. Interview number 14 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2019. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.